improv. It's not just for comedy on stage anymore. What is the role of improv in our lives, in our politics? Stay tuned. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
Bravery and freedom. Creativity. Having fun. What do these things have to do with politics? Well, much more than you might think. Who among us has the courage to improvise in a public arena, risk people yelling at us, get off the stage, and the stamina to do it again and again and again until you successfully connect and actually inspire? Can you go out there all alone and make people laugh or help spark a powerful political movement? One reviewer said our guest today, Randy Fertel, shines a piercing light into the shadows of the so-called improv style in politics. Few of us can wing it. Few of us can wing it well, and improv is an art whose power, he argues, should not be underestimated. In his new book, Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Age of Trump, author Randy Fertel brings a breadth of knowledge and a deep enthusiasm to an exploration of improv's centuries-long influence in music and art, as well as its contemporary role in politics, social media, AI, business, neuroscience, and more. The best, most creative chefs certainly improvise in the kitchen. Many of us are fans of such improv performances as Second City, but in this new book, Fertel reveals how improvisation goes far beyond the comedy stage. He describes how improv is a vital artistic and cultural phenomenon that we should not underestimate. If a politician is unable to improvise on the public stage, oof, he or she faces serious difficulty in making the sale. And the fact is, Donald Trump is indeed skilled at the use of improv, and that's to his great benefit. Ugh. Well, there's a lot to discuss. Randy Fertel, thanks so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive.
I'm happy to be here, Bert. Thank you.
Randy Fertel is a writer and philanthropist dedicated to the arts, education, New Orleans. We'll talk a lot about New Orleans and the environment. Fertel holds a PhD in English and American Literature from Harvard University. Well, I've heard of that. And is the author of A Taste for Chaos, The Art of Literary Improvisation, and The Gorilla Man and the Empress of Steak, a New Orleans family memoir. Fertel has taught English at Harvard University, Tulane University, Le Moyne College, and the New School for Social Research. He specializes in literature of the Vietnam War and the literature of exile. In addition to his writing, Fertel is president of the Fertel Foundation and the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, named for his mother, Ruth Fertel, founder of Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. He is co-founder of the Ridenhour Prizes for Courageous Truth-Telling, now in its 20th year. He lives in New Orleans and New York. Well, again, thanks so much for being with us. Well, when one thinks of improv, the likes of such greats as Robin Williams, Jonathan Winters, and the remarkable and brave comedic acts of the Second City in general probably come to mind. So let's start by defining terms. What is improv? What is the role? What is its role in our culture that we may not fully recognize as improv? What do we lose when we think, when we only think of improv as entertainment?
Well, to get at a definition of improv, let me start with the origin story of my work. I was in a graduate seminar, and the professor, we had read this obscure Renaissance pamphlet. And the professor, just to get the conversation started, he didn't mean anything by it, said, "I bet you've never read anything like this before." And I thought, well, no, it's like Tristram Shandy, and it's like Don Juan, it's like this, and all my favorite books. It was like all my favorite books. And luckily, I didn't say anything because I didn't really know how they connected. They would have torn me apart. It was a graduate seminar. But I kept thinking about it. And so it was kind of synchronistic, his opening. "I bet you've never seen anything like this before," because that's what I decided was the thing that linked them. They all claimed to be something new under the sun. They all claimed to be improvised, impromptu. something you've never seen before. So, but to get at the art of improvisation, we need to add something to that definition. Oscar Wilde's remark that spontaneity is a meticulously prepared art.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So our conversation, this conversation is impromptu, but I'm weaving together phrases and ideas from my book, really from my two books on improv, ideas that I've thought long and hard about. So improv isn't totally off the cuff. Mm-hmm. There's an art to it. Kerouac in the 50s offered a rule book. He called it The Essentials of Spontaneous Prose. And he wrote on the road on a scroll, 130-foot scroll, without pagination, without paragraphs, without punctuation. And he presented this to the people at Ferris Strauss and Giroux, and they said, well, you know, we'll have to edit this. And he said, this came from the Holy Ghost.
Yeah.
And he laughed. He went out on the street, if not on the road. But then 6 years later, he comes back after 6 years of editing it. I'm not sure which of the Holy Trinity did the editing. Mm. He comes back with the book that is published, and it has this huge impact. You know, how much of the 60s came out of, I mean, I'm a literary guy, so maybe I give it more weight than it deserves, but it had an effect on me. It helped radicalize me when I read it in the late 60s. So, was it spontaneous? Was it an improvisation? It was edited. When I presented some early pages of my book, Taste for Chaos, to my chairman at the New School, he just dismissed it. He said, you can't talk about an improvised novel. Well, but what if it gives the impression that it was improvised? Mm. Is only the scroll an improvisation? In fact, the scroll was the fourth draft. He had done three other drafts. So it's only the first sketch. So, you know, I think we need to throw out the question, is it really improvised? There's a tendency to ask three questions. Is it improvised enough? Is it improvised too much? Or is it improvised just right? And I think we need to throw those questions along with Goldilocks out the door, because the critical study of improvisation demands that we look at the power of the impression of improvisation, what I call the rhetoric of spontaneity, the persuasive power of spontaneity.
The power of the impression. That's interesting. And certainly people like Abbie Hoffman in the late 60s used that quite a bit, to just make a statement seemingly improvised with very few words. And just it was a spark that got people moving.
He was magnificent.
He was magnificent.
He was seal this book.
Yeah.
And do you know that he was during that Chicago 7 trial, mm-hmm. he was at night. He was going to Second City and participating in sets. People ate him up.
I know he had talked about trying to do a stand-up show in Manhattan, and it didn't really work. I got to know the man a little bit. Quite an honor. What was your purpose in writing this book? You've written a few books. Who is your target audience? Why did you write this book?
Well, so my first book, The Art of Taste for Chaos, The Art of Literary Improvisation, came out of that dissertation that came out of that seminar. And it was meant, like the dissertation, to change the way academia looked at improvisation. I argued that it had a much larger role in the development of the Western canon, you know, how the dead white guys tried to get to the mainstream, how to disrupt the mainstream, change the mainstream so they could be part of it. Well, 3 months after I published the book in 2015, here comes the orange man down the golden escalator. Mm-hmm. And I heard that first speech and I thought, man, I knew there was a dark side to this. Improvisers have long been talking about how, you know, you can't always trust in inspiration. You never know where it's coming from, what demon is whispering in your ear. Mm. For example, Coleridge in Kubla Khan, the great ode to inspiration of the romantic imagination and the powers of inspiration. At the end of it, he says, "Weave a circle round him thrice, for he on honeydew hath fed and drunk the milk of paradise. Beware, beware." So there's a dark side to improv, and improvisers have long known it. But, you know, I had no idea how dark it could be. And knowing its power, I saw right away that there were real dangers here. And so I resolved to write a book about popular culture and politics and meant for a popular audience.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the cover from the 15th century. The cover of your book is, I believe, a Hieronymus Bosch painting. Why that?
Yeah, isn't it wonderful? I presented a painting that I had commissioned to my publisher. And he's an art historian, and he took one look and said, "I don't think." And overnight, so it's an improvisation. I think it tests as an improvisation. Overnight, he came up with this cover. He's an art historian, so, you know, it's a meticulously prepared art. He knew his art history. But this is the hell part of Bosch's triptych called The Garden of Earthly Delights.
Right.
And the middle centerpiece, the wonderful centerpiece, and this is a painting that's 12 feet long. It's huge. It's meant for an altar. And his central panel is full of fun and games and earthly pleasures. The hell portion is the world Trump is driving us toward. Mm. And already exists in his mind, in his vision of American carnage. I owe a lot to my publisher, Klaus Ottmann, for this cover that everybody loves. Everybody loves.
Nice.
I wish it would win an award. It deserves it.
Well, I imagine so. I mean, Hieronymus Bosch, that's a very famous painting and easily recognizable. Yeah. We talked about Trump a little bit. We got to talk about him some more. As opposed to the carefully crafted and poll-tested language people expect of politicians, one of Trump's great advantages politically is his seemingly off-the-cuff speaking style, which is perceived as authentic and straight-shooting. Please tell us about the persuasive power of Trump's seemingly charismatic speaking style in the historical context of improvisation, Randy.
Well, charisma is one thing, and then the apparent spontaneity is another thing. So we'll come back to charisma. I call it the rhetoric of spontaneity, as I said. The appearance of spontaneity has great persuasive power. We seem to distrust the mind and its artifice. And there's a whole tradition in the West and in the East where we long for things that are natural, that are untouched by artifice. And so when Trump goes off script, says things that are inappropriate, uses curse words, things that are unpresidential, it has great power. Every commentator, it seems, says something about his embrace of improvisation, but then they just dismiss it as unpresidential. It's not the way, it's not decorous. It's not the way a presidential person would speak.
That's for sure.
And they pretty much argued that, you know, no one with such a manner can win 51% of the vote, and which of course he didn't. But What they missed was this power of spontaneity, the power of indecorousness, the power of seeming to be saying whatever comes to mind. And for one thing, it fit with his argument. His argument was that the coastal elites have infiltrated the deep state with their logic and rationality and decorous behavior, and he would make, remember that bit where he would make fun of, well, I can be presidential, and he would be stuffy and every bit of unstuffiness that he brought to his rallies, his base ate up. It, for one thing, it reads as authentic, it reads as authoritative, and it reads as relatable. They feel like he's one of us.
Right.
He doesn't drink, so you can't have a beer with him, but he's relatable.
Yeah. Yeah, he's one of us. That's his strength. And as opposed to, you know, the careful language, the poll-tested language that the people expect from mainstream politicians, it connects.
But he's poll-testing. He's doing A-B tests. One of the superpowers of the improviser is that he or she is a great listener. He's a super listener. They pay attention. And Trump may not listen to you or me. He may not listen to the adults in the room, but he listens to his audience. And he's a narcissist, so he wants feedback. He's addicted to feedback. And I was listening on MSNBC last night. They were talking about how he doesn't gauge whether it's positive or negative feedback. It's just about the amount. And so, for example, it's a documented fact that one of his handlers, wanting him to speak about the immigration problem in a speech, put a little icon of a wall as a mnemonic to make him remember to talk about immigration. So he made that metaphor into a thing, and all of a sudden he's proposing a wall. We'll build a wall. We'll make the Mexicans pay for it. Well, the way that audience responded was so explosive that the next thing you know, it's a plank in his platform and one of his key policies. So, I mean, that's a case of the tail wagging the dog, but it also came out of improvisation.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Randy Fertel. He's talking about his new book, Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Age of Trump. And there is a lot to talk about here. And you and I mean, I've seen a lot of politicians who just don't read the room. It amazes me. What do they expect? What does that mean? And what about the ability or lack thereof is so important, reading the room?
Well, you make me think of Huey Long, who was great at reading a room but shaped the way the room would be read. Like, he would receive reporters in his pajamas at the Roosevelt Hotel. He would show people how to make a Ramos gin fizz at the famous Sazerac bar. Just, was full of charisma and people ate it up. Reading the room. So, well, let's use an example that may not first come to mind, but which I found very powerful when Biden at the first and also the second State of the Union address improvised, quote unquote, it was apparently meticulously prepared by his handlers. He improvised this talk about Social Security and the Republicans' plan to sundown it after five years, we would have to be revoted. And he knew that they would rise to this red meat.
Yes.
And sure enough, the heckles came loud and clear.
Yep.
And when one of them yelled, "We didn't say we're against Social Security, Medicare," he said, "Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. I'll count on your vote." So he had him in the palm of his hand. So he read the room, but he shaped the room that he read. You know, having read the room, he knew how to shape it going forward. And that's, you know, that's what improvisation is great at. Improvisation is the art of following forked paths, of finding a way through a door that has no way through. It's the art of finding a way, making a way out of no way. And every step of the way, we face decisions. And the improviser is so in tune with the present moment that he or she makes decisions that, because he's in a charismatic state, he pulls off. You know, every decision we make is not the best decision, but it's the best decision that we can make at the moment, and we just have to carry it through. And that's what improvisers do. So in comic improv, you know, there's a set of simple rules, a kind of algorithm. And the first rule is yes and, the call and response, the rule of agreement. If I say there's an ogre chasing me, you can't say there are no ogres. You have to say something like, "Whoa, yeah, I see that. And what an overbite." So that's call and response. That's taking what I say, agreeing with it, but taking it a next step. What could have been like a horror show of ogres chasing me suddenly becomes a comedy. Oh, what an overbite. So out of that simple forked path comes a entire coherent narrative, sometimes an hour long. There's a kind of comic improv called the Herald, named by the comic genius of the comic improv movement, Del Close. And it from a simple audience prompt, or no prompt at all, a whole hour-long narrative that's coherent and not necessarily funny, because Del Close used to say that if you're looking for the next joke, you're stuck on a, you know, endless carousel. You'll never get off. What we're looking for is gasps of recognition.
Yeah.
And that's what the great comic improv creates. This book, I was in Cambridge in the 70s and 80s, and comic improv was alive and happening, but I wasn't aware of it. I was stuck in the library. So there's a little bit of comic improv in that first book. There's much more of it in this book. I learned a lot from it. I took a class with UBC. I did enough to say I did a little. I'm not going to, you started by saying, you know, asking, you know, are you good enough to improvise? And I'm going to tell you, it's not my forte. It's not what I'm best at. Though I was committed as in teaching to discussion method, which is an improvisational method.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe in lectures. And in my book launch and in the book events, I'm trying to have conversations rather than to give talks. And I really believe in that.
Yeah, and I think that's, frankly, one of the Orange One's strength is connecting with people, having talks with people. He doesn't lecture to people. And at his most recent State of the Union, Joe Biden didn't lecture as much as he connected with and talked with and you know, worked with people who were in the audience. And that takes quite a skill. And as a recovering politician myself, I can tell you, I did get elected to the state Senate in here in New Hampshire 7 times, but I would get nervous every time speaking before the public. And I usually bring at least some notes because it's scary to do that. It is scary to do that. It takes a great skill to improvise and to be able to connect with people. But those few times that it did happen, I remember. And it's like, I did. Well, the right wing throughout the 20th and 21st centuries has sought to put a lid on art. Oh, if it's not soothing and doesn't reinforce conventional dominant culture, oh, we got to ban it. But as art appreciators know, from Dadaism through the abstract, often intentionally challenging expressions and odd twists on what we generally perceive as reality, art very often intends to challenge orthodoxy. In a kind of philosophical sense, what is it about art and the concept of freedom as it relates to what we're talking about?
Well, so improvisation presents itself as just fun and games. This is just a laugh. I'm just noodling around here. Let's have fun. Uh-huh. But there's a undercurrent of purpose in all improv. When I get on stage and say, listen, I've given this no thought, so trust me, I'm basically throwing thought, logic, rationality, evidence, I'm throwing it under the bus. There's something more to life, to mind, than logic and reason. And neuroscience is confirming this, that the mind, the rationality may be that our crown and glory, but it comes up through the embodied emotions. The body knows before the brain does. When that saber-toothed tiger comes through the canebrake, I'm running before my mind says run.
Yeah.
My body tells me my endorphins and my all the hormones are telling me run before the word is in my mouth. So there's great truth to what improvisers have been saying and doing since antiquity, which is to say, listen, logic isn't the whole story. There's more to it. And of course, where this tends is toward innovation, toward change, toward paradigm shifts, toward enriching rationality, not throwing rationality out for good, but taking that strict and rigid kind of rationality that doesn't allow for creativity or innovation, throwing that under the bus and bringing instead a rationality that embraces intuition, instinct, and embodied emotions. So that's what improv has been preaching, I say with scare quotes, because it would die if it were caught preaching, but it's got something to say, and it's an important lesson that I'm thinking of a third book now, and the title would be The Age of Improv, because think about it, improv has dominated the 20th and 21st centuries. Start with jazz, rhythm and blues, the method in acting, Freud and Jung, the spontaneity in inherent in their talking cures, rock and roll, rap, on and on. And then comic improv, of course. And hip hop. So in many ways, we're living in the age of culture, in the cultural avant-garde is the age of improv. Meanwhile, the mainstream is the opposite. It's the age of rigid rationality. And so the reason we live in the age of improv is because we the mainstream is the age of rigid rationality that we need pushing back against. Mm-hmm. So the right is against this and any kind of innovation is no surprise. They don't just want to maintain the mainstream. They want to go back to the 1850s, right, as Arizona recently has.
Yeah, they really do. And striving against, pushing back against that mainstream, that does have quite an appeal, I must say. It really does. And that's connected, obviously. Donald Trump has done that exceedingly well. And I do think that one of her problems back in 2016, Hillary Clinton, was she was the East and West Coast. She was the mainstream. She was careful about what she said, and a total mainstream. And Donald Trump shook it up. He shook it up, and actually, he did win. And so we're in a situation now where, she ran against her campaign was "I'm not Donald Trump." Well, Joe Biden, in his State of the Union speech, did a lot more than that. And I think he has to do a lot more than that. He has to be somebody that catches on and connects with people and push, just people catch on. And that's not something that normally average politicians do. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Randy Fertel, who's got a new book out, Winging It: Improv's Power and Peril in the Age of Trump. And you remind me of a story about the rationality. In one of his races for president, an enthusiastic woman gushed to then-candidate Governor Adlai Stevenson. So it was either 52 or 56. I don't know. She said, "Oh, Governor Stevenson, all thinking Americans will vote for you." He said, "Well, that's great, ma'am. Thank you very much. But I need a majority." Here, I'm referring to what you say in Winging It, that improv requires the actor to use what you call hot cognition informed by intuition, which elicits different feelings than thought patterns that are formulaic and studied. How does your concept of improvisation play in what the two are addressing and in the current 2024 presidential race? What is it about the power of the gut we're seeing in the Trump campaign that Democrats usually miss?
Well, I love that Stevenson story. I had never heard it, and it's just wonderful. I just love that. That's great, man, but I need a majority. We America's not known for its thoughtfulness. It's thinking Americans are not in the majority.
No.
And but as you say, politicians need to speak to the gut. They need to speak from the gut, and they need to speak to the gut.
Yep.
Kennedy gave us the impression of speaking from the gut because he was such a great speaker. He used chiasmus, asked not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. X, Y, Y, X, chiasmus. So it's a meticulously prepared art, but it conveys how deeply he felt it. That's the the flaw in improv's promise, that if it's unmediated and without art, it's true. That's not true. And I have a whole riff in my book on the improv's promise of naturalness, because it's natural. You know, like Trump says, "My gut knows more than many brains." Trust me, because I've given this no thought. That is based on the notion that if it's natural, it's good. It's authentic, authoritative. But, there are a lot of great thinkers challenge this idea of natural. I'm blanking on the names. I have that problem of the amygdala seizing up when I know a name's coming and I can't find it. But the guy who wrote 1984, George Orwell,
yes.
Called it's one of the great natural is one of the great scandals of philosophy. And it does more to poison political discourse than anything. So things natural are not better. They're maybe not even natural. It's a figment for improv makes a lot of promises that it's unmediated, that it's immediate, it's done impromptu, totally impromptu. We know that's not totally the truth. That it's unmediated, that it's not shaped by frames. I don't have any models. My mind isn't shaping it. It's my gut. So that is not necessarily true. And so natural is something to be skeptical of. And basically, I wrote the book to prepare people when they hear someone say, my gut knows more than many brains, trust me, because I've given this no thought, to watch their wallets. It's time to watch your wallets when you hear that. It's time to watch your freedoms. It's time to watch your democracy, because that's what he's coming for.
Oh, that is truly scary, and I can see your point there, that in saying that and just connecting with the gut, we've seen throughout history charismatic leaders who speak from the gut, and then some horrible, horrible things happen as a result once they get in power. We don't need to be too specific here. I think we know what we're talking about.
You probably didn't stumble on this as I did, but Laura Trump, who's Trump's daughter-in-law and handpicked head for the RNC and clearly one of his surrogates, she aspires to being a songstress. She puts out records. I think she sums up the Trumpian ethos when she writes and sings a song at the heart of which is the resident sentence, don't think, just jump.
Yeah.
Don't think, just jump. She says it again and again, don't think, just jump. That's exactly what they want. Good don't Lord. Think. And that's why I wrote the book, because once you've thrown logic and reason under the bus, how do you reach people who hear your reasoning and just say, well, get under the bus. I don't want you. You know, there's no retreat. And that, you know, at the end of the book, I'm concerned with the tribalism that we've fallen into. I don't want to just rehearse this us versus them scenario. We need to learn to talk to one another.
Yes.
It's not going to be easy. I have no easy ways forward. But, you know, democracy is about a conversation. It's about the notion that every voice counts. Every vote counts.
Yes.
Every voice should be heard.
Yes.
Every voice should be heard is at the heart of improvisation. And democracy is an improvisation. It was our democracy, which threw George III under the bus, was something new under the sun. A nation that wrote a written constitution that was going to be based on a written constitution, flawed in ways that are emerging every day. But it was about a conversation, and it was about persuasion. It was about people in a conversation where they tried to persuade one another. The trouble with tribalism is that the two tribes look at one another. I've done it. and said, oh, I can't reach him. He's irrational. He's like an animal. I'm just going to go with my tribe. Well, that way, you know,
it's not necessarily a way to win.
And so you need a conversation and you need persuasion. And in the end, you need compromise. You can't get to compromise without conversation.
And the whole idea of saying about what, well, that certain famous person said, the basket of deplorables. You don't say that to the people who are doing the hiring. And, you know, in the tribalism, the East and the West Coast versus the middle of America, you know, if they're unredeemable, if we're never going to get them, we lose. But the point, in my opinion, is we have to listen. We have to understand where they're coming from and try to connect with that. And you know, it, when Democrats talk at them, it's not doing that. It's a scary situation. But maybe improv has a place in reaching the people that didn't vote for Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton, but that perhaps, I mean, if we keep at it the same way, is treating them like, oh, the enemy, that ain't going to work. That's not going to work.
You had an author on who wrote a book about urging Biden to do a whistle stop, a train program.
Yes.
And that would be an improvisation, right? That is... But in its nature, an improvisation. And so I think that, and that, of course, would reach this, the heartland,
yes,
which beyond Pennsylvania, he doesn't seem to be aware of.
Maybe that's a way.
I think I need to team up with your other podcast author.
Well, maybe so. We need to figure out something because we can't lose this thing. We need, you know, those of us.
There's a lot at stake.
America, as we've known it, is at stake. And New Orleans plays a big part in your book. All American cities have their own unique personality. Let's talk about the influence of one of America's most lively cultures, that of New Orleans. What is it about their reputation for lively jazz, savoir-faire, their decision to turn toward living well that relates to your points in winging it? Is there something of unique value for the rest of the country to learn from? Something about escaping the rigid pull of the metronome, enabling a bit of syncopation and fun to play in our lives? Let's talk about this and its unique attraction.
Yeah, I think we're good at those things. When I stumbled on this lens to look at culture through the lens of improvisation, after a while I realized, man, I was born to do this.
Nice
because
feeling.
Not only this polarity between the mainstream in improvisation is inscribed in our map. The original map of New Orleans is a Cartesian grid. The famous French Quarter, the Vieux Carré, is a Cartesian grid, 1718, just at the time of Descartes. And but just outside the grid was a space dedicated to the enslaved people who were allowed, according to the Code Noir, the French Black Code, were allowed to play their drums and other instruments as they could nowhere else in America, in no other colony were they allowed to do that. And though it's called Congo Square, actually what was dominant there were circles. There were drum circles and dancing circles. And so inscribed in our map is this opposition between the French rigid Cartesian grid and the Afrocentric, non-rational, not irrational, but non-rational, embodied dancing and drumming. And so I published a piece on that in Common Edge, an urbanist online site. But so, yes, New Orleans, number one, besides that deep history, New Orleans did more to bring improvisation to the light of modern culture than anything. I mean, New Orleans, traditional jazz, Louis Armstrong was the first solo improviser or improv soloist. And by the way, in my family memoir, I did some historical research, and my family is from Rampart Street, which is really where jazz was born. It wasn't born in Storyville, that came later. But Buddy Bolden and Louis Armstrong, all those people were from North or South Rampart Street. And my family had a loan office there. And my great aunt Nettie married a man whose father sold Louis his first cornet. So how's that for a connection?
Cool.
So a little attenuated, but I'll take it. So anyway, so jazz is, you know, if you look at high modernism, T.S. Eliot and all those guys, they're all referencing jazz. Of course, Fitzgerald's, Great Gatsby. And it becomes a dominant force in shaping culture. And I don't know, I've never thought of it before, but I wonder how much FDR's work was clearly it was improvised. It was something new under the sun. Yes. Social Security. He took a lot of heat from the Maitre for that.
Yeah.
So anyway, the century is New Orleans is the launching pad for much of the century, and I guess you could say Katrina was a launching pad for our final awareness of environment problems, of climate change.
Interesting. And, you know, I think the appeal of jazz, of Afrocentric music is very big in this country. You know, obviously the right wing doesn't want to see that. They want to deny that. But there is a tremendous appeal to that. And some of the greatest music of the late 60s, the rock music, a lot of that was improvised. You take the group Cream. I mean, they were not jazz, but boy, did they improvise. And they made some great stuff. And a bunch of others did too. We're talking about improvisation here with our guest today, Randy Fertel, who's got a new book out called Winging It, Improv's Power and Peril in the Age of Trump. And the book has some inviting, curious chapter titles. Chapter one is Improv's Dark Side, Hookup Sex, COVID-19, and Donald Trump. What?
Well, so, you know, this was my COVID project. I finally settled down to writing it on Mardi Gras Day 2020, which was the first super spreader event.
Yeah.
And the idea, the voice that I was looking for finally came to me, and I had to decide, do I stay home and get this started or go out there? Well, it turned out to be the super spreader event, 80,000 infections. Jeez. So as far as I'm concerned, the book saved my life, and maybe it'll save a few others. but I say that to so here I am all by myself with my computer, and I'm just following wherever the last improviser sends me. I'm just following my nose. And one of the books I stumble on is by this Tulane sociologist whom I've yet to meet. I really need to meet Lisa Wade. She writes a book on sexual hookup culture on American campuses today. Mm. And her definition of it, this form of casual sex, is when I hear it, I can't not think improv. Yeah. Listen to what she says. She says, hookup culture is spontaneous but scripted, order out of disorder, and unruly routine. It isn't short, a feat of social engineering. Each of those tensions is characteristic of improvisation. While purporting to be without purpose, just a whim or lark, improv covertly takes aim at feats of social engineering. Trump is trying to, you know, destroy, you know, through chaos, this thing we call democracy. So that's the ultimate in social disengineering or whatever. And then I go into the, in that chapter, I go into Trump as dark improviser. And, and of course, COVID itself is an improvisation. It's something new under the sun. This wedding of whatever two animals it was in that marketplace in China, that's something new under the sun. It's a hybrid. Hybrid is a big piece of improv. It's a weaving together of things that already exist to form something new, a tinkering, a bricolage, as the French say. And so, and then the COVID vaccine too was an improvisation.
Oh, interesting.
And done with amazing speed, a speed that Hermes would have envied, because they had this Carico, this Hungarian immigrant biologist, had the method for creating the vaccine a month before the Chinese came out with the genetic code, the whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. And so they had the vaccine on the table within a week of the DNA reading of COVID. So it's an amazing story, which I tell in that chapter. It was a fun chapter. I learned so much. I learned so much writing this book, which is the joy of writing.
Ah, indeed. Well, I learned so much from doing this show, I'll tell you. I'm amazed.
And I bet.
And you know, going on to learn new things, and science often, you know, doesn't intend so many accidents, you know, like, oh, I didn't intend, you know, and we come up with the great things unintentionally.
Yeah, penicillin.
Interesting. Yeah, you're right. So many things that in science, improv can't be overstated. What about, what do we need to know about the dark side of intuition and instinct? You got to be a little careful of that stuff as well, giving too much power to instinct and impulse.
Well, that's my chapter on the detective novel, Poe's early detective fiction and later detective fiction, is basically a opposition between a cold cognition, protocol-driven head of detectives and someone who's ready to break protocol and use intuition and get the job done. So, for example, in Poe's The Purloined Letter, the chief detective has torn apart this apartment where they know this purloined letter has been hidden. Uh-huh. And they can't find it. And so they approach Chevalier Dupin. And Dupin knows the villain and has a way of getting inside the villain's consciousness by intuition. And he sees right away that it was just stuck on the desk. It was, you know, it wasn't hidden at all. It was right there in plain sight. You might remember this from high school, as I did. So we're almost out of time. So I'm worried about getting into this, but I take this into one of the dominant cultural forces today is Marvel Comic Universe. And our Marvel
Yeah,
I think it's Marvel Comic Universe. And, you know, which started with Iron Man, which was totally improvised, and lots of evidence of that. And the thing about Dupin is that he has a grudge against the villain. And so that's the dark side of his intuition, that he has a purpose. It's not just a method. It's an axe. He's got an axe to grind.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the superhero narratives, you know, vigilantism is the dark underbelly, the soft underbelly of these narratives.
Oh,
and,
interesting.
They're all, you know, they're all over the place, and I won't list them. But The Boys is the send-up of all the Marvel comic superheroes who, you know, like Spider-Man, who his how many of his criminals ever find their way to a court of justice?
Mm.
You know, that distaste for protocol, for rationality and logic, is not a lot different from the vigilante, what the vigilantes were carrying to January 6th.
Interesting.
And so it's, you know, I'm a little like that guy in The Beautiful Mind, the science, the mathematician who makes connections every which way and turns out to be psychotic.
Yeah.
So, you know, the next book may be written from the insane asylum, but I see improv, I see it everywhere. And I think that I have my finger on this deep, like rhizomatic network in that's beneath our culture.
Wow.
Where the cognitive and the embodied are fighting a battle. And the point, you know, Einstein is said to have said, it's attributed to Einstein, that the intuitive mind is a sacred gift. The rational mind is a faithful servant. We have created a society that honors the servant and has forgotten the gift.
Mm.
I think Einstein was a very generous man, and I think what he really meant to say was that the rational mind is an unfaithful servant, that the rational mind doesn't pay attention to the sacred gift like it should. And the point is that the intuitive and the rational mind, the Daniel Kahneman's fast and slow thinking, neuroscience's hot and cold cognition, these are inscribed in our everyday life, and we project them into all our cultural ramifications. And the point is that they're meant to work together.
Uh-huh.
Rational and intuitive are meant to work together. But there's actual neuroscience that shows how the rational usurps that in a body in the base of the mind called the corpus callosum, where it controls the interchange between the left and right brains.
Well, we've run out of time, and there's a lot to learn here. This is fascinating stuff. And, you know, you can't underestimate the power of improv that you're talking about. Our guest today, fascinating, has been Randy Fertel. Winging It is his new book, Improv's Power and Peril in the Age of Trump. And who's the publisher?
Spring Publications. And my website is fertel.com. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and you can also get it at an independent bookstore through my website, fertel.com, F-E-R-T-E-L.
Hey, thank you so much. Fascinating discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Bert. Really enjoyed it.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Please ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.